This is program number 15 of the Does God Exist audio series. John Clayton is your speaker. This particular program is a continuation of program number 14. We've been talking about evolution. We started back in program number 12 by looking carefully at definitions. Evolution is not a dirty word. It's not even a four-letter word. Evolution simply means an unfolding type of change. And what has happened is that we have confused the fact that things can change with naturalism, with the belief of some that God can be excluded from the process of creating the heavens and the earth by understanding the natural processes that have been involved in producing all that we see. What we've tried to do is to look at the fossil record, to see how the fossil record agrees or disagrees with what the biblical record says. And there is a complete agreement between the sequence that the biblical record gives and what the fossil record shows. In program number 13, we dealt with the issue of dating. And we tried to point out both biblically and scientifically that there are massive assumptions involved in any dating technique, and that from a biblical perspective, the most accurate thing we can do and say is that the Bible simply does not give the age of the earth. That there are too many assumptions that have to be made about the Bible in order to be able to try and affix a date to the earth's creation or to the creation of life upon the earth. We've also pointed out that there are many denominations that have a reason for demanding a particular time to the earth in order to fit their creed, in order to fit their teachings, dispensationalism being the most obvious. But if we're just talking about what the Bible says, if we're just concerned about seeing the record as revealed in the rocks, then we will see that the Bible simply does not give an age to the earth. The scientific methods have assumptions involved in them. But perhaps the most compelling reason for believing that the earth has some considerable age is that the scientific methods work. And as I have said to you, I have supported this ministry for over 45 years by my consulting work as a geologist. Being able to understand the history of the earth, being able to determine what resources might be commercially available deep within the ground, is important to the survival of mankind. And it is rather inconsistent for people to use the information and the product of these types of research and then try on some religious basis to deny it. The Bible and science are friends. They are not enemies. And if there is a conflict between science and faith, between science and our understanding of the Bible, either we have bad science, which is always something we have to be aware of, or we have bad theology, which is something we also have to be aware of. And we started back in the very first program in this series by looking at some of the mistakes that people have made in regards to what the Bible says and what they have assumed it says, which has led them to atheistic postures. And it's important in the question of evolution to realize there's been a great deal of hostility and a great deal of debate that was totally unnecessary. But people came to the discussion with vested interest, religiously, morally, or otherwise. And as a result of that, there has been this huge controversy brought before our young people, which has been very destructive to them. So again, I'm saying to you that the fossil record and the biblical record are not at odds. And that the reason we see conflict is because of denominational tradition, not because of what the record actually says. So in the last program, we started out by looking at the difference between the process of creating and the process of making. Creating, from the Hebrew word bara, referring to something that only God can do. And if we take that position, if we restrict our interpretation of the Bible to simply taking literally what the words mean, then the most significant creation verse in Genesis 1 is the first verse. In the beginning, God created the heaven and the earth. The Hebrew word used there for creation is the Hebrew word bara. It is not the word asah, which refers to something man or God can do, and is used in much of the chapters in Genesis 1 as well as later. It is also not the same as the word for formed, used specifically in reference to man's body. God formed man of the dust of the earth. The Hebrew word yatsur, normally used in reference to something that an artist would do in molding a pot or something like that, but in this case, applied to man. So the creation began in verse 1, and the creation process, something God can uniquely do, is described in verse 1. We will very shortly in a later DVD show that the Bible continuously refers to the fact that wisdom and purpose and design is involved in this process. And in our day of quantum mechanics and a new understanding of the nature of matter, string theory, brain theory, we are finding more and more evidence of the validity of the statement that there was a specific beginning by a process that did not involve any kind of natural physical thing that is taking place today. So bara, used in verse 1. Another word used in verse 1 which is significant is the word shachim. That word is translated heaven. And what it refers to is everything up there. The other word used is eretz, which refers to everything down here. The basic message then is beautifully simple. God created everything. But what is the up there? Well, it would include the galaxies, the nebula, the comets, the asteroids, the meteoroids, the planets, the stars, the sun, the moon. And the point we tried to make there was that the sun and the moon are created in verse 1, not in verses 14 through 19, which has been traditionally assumed. They are created in verse 1. The light from these objects came to the earth in verse 3. There is no difficulty in explaining the light in verse 3 if we understand the sun and the moon to be a part of verse 1. Those who have assumed that there was no sun or moon until verses 14 through 19 have to come up with some explanation for the light in verse 3. And usually some type of theological explanation is what is attempted there. But if we take it very literally, that's not the issue. As a matter of fact, what's interesting is that in verses 14 through 19, what is said is that God caused night and day to become measurable upon the earth. Verse 14, let them be for signs and for seasons and for days and for years. So the sun and the moon and the stars and the cosmos are created in verse 1. The light came to the earth by verse 3. But for some reason, you could not establish signs, seasons, days, or years until verses 14 through 19. And my suggestion was that this very well may be cloud cover. There are other verses which indicate it didn't rain early in the earth's history, specifically in chapter 2. Then what happened was that there was a cloud cover which prevented you from being able to establish the chronometers. And this process then was a process with the frame of reference being the earth. We also pointed out that the concept of there being one land mass and one body of water is consistent with verses 9 and 10. We also pointed out that the sequence of life, and I want to emphasize again that word, the sequence of life, the order in which life occurred, is very, very consistent with the fossil record. Verses 11 and 12 indicate that plants were the first thing to occur and that plants occurred in a definite order. Tishay, referring to things that were easily broken, moss, lichen. Asib, referring to naked seeds, translated herb, referring to your gymnosperms. And peri, indicating flowering tree, the angiosperms. Now, those of you familiar with the fossil record will say, well, yeah, but there's a huge amount of time evident in the fossil record between the time of the algae and the time of the gymnosperms and then later the time of the angiosperms. Well, that's the reason I keep saying it is the sequence that is given. The time issue is not the issue. Only if you are restricting this to some human frame of reference, which would be inconsistent with the fact that the sun and the moon and the stars are established as not being used for time until verses 14 through 19, only then do you have a problem. We saw that the first living thing upon the earth were things in the ocean. Verse 20, the first part, talks about swarming creature. It is a word which refers to a wide range of marine creatures. The latter part of verse 20 talks about the winged fowl, kanaf, in the original Hebrew. And that is, again, consistent with the fossil record. But again, it's important to realize that the material that shows the early marine forms were at a much earlier time than the birds. The sequence is the issue. Verses 24 through 25 talks about the cattle, behemoth, the mammals, and then later man, the most recent thing to occur upon the earth. I'd like to point out to you that this view of the sequence is very literal. It is very non-traditional, and I'm not asking you to buy into it. I'm simply asking you to realize there is an argument to be made for the integrity of the sequence of Genesis 1. What is also interesting is that when you start looking at the alternatives to this, and when you start looking at the other evidence to it, it is strongly supported. And let's talk about a few of those peripheral issues. For example, we're all familiar with the tree of evolution. We're all familiar with the fact that many, many years back in the early 20th century, it was proposed that life started with protozoans, and that as time progressed, different forms of life occurred, ultimately culminating in man. The traditional tree of evolution. What is important to understand about that tree is it's not a very good model. The problem is, first of all, that sometimes animals that are extremely primitive and would be expected to be at the very bottom of the tree turn out to be at the top of the tree. And my favorite example of that is the trilobite. The trilobite is an index fossil for the Cambrian period. It's an animal that is believed to be related to the horseshoe crab. It's a marine creature. What's interesting about it is that it is an index fossil for the Cambrian period. Now, what that means is the Cambrian period is the period when life began upon the earth, at least when it began to proliferate and appear enormous numbers in the fossil record. The trilobite is an index fossil for that period, which means it had worldwide distribution and is clearly seen throughout all places where Cambrian rocks appear. So the trilobite should be at the bottom of the tree because it's one of the first forms of life to occur upon the earth. If you look at any representation of the tree of evolution, however, you will see it at the top of the tree. I'm looking at the one from the Museum of Natural History in Chicago, and they have it at the very, very top of the tree. Why is the trilobite at the top of the tree when, chronologically, in terms of when it lived, it should be at the bottom of the tree? Well, the problem is that the trilobite is a very complex form of life. The eye of the trilobite was so advanced that it is really better than any eye of any living creature today. At least that's the claim of some scientists. In New York Academy of the Sciences magazine, there was an article back in the last century which was titled Nature's Most Perfect Eye, and it was the eye of the trilobite. The eye was of such complexity that it could look at something a foot away and something a mile away, and they'd both be in focus at the same time. You try that. I have trouble with my book and my wife's face, and I think it's important to understand that this complexity caused it to be placed at the top of the tree. But it is found in the earliest rocks. So there's an adjustment problem here. There's a system problem in where the trilobite is classified. We also have difficulties in links. And I think it's kind of important to realize that the difficulties are frequently problems because of the way the classification is set up. Many people don't realize, but Linnaeus' classification system was based on evolution. The problem was that there were difficulties in some of the groupings. If, in fact, the tree of evolution were the case, in fact, if it was the workable, perfect model, then there should be animals that you would find in between forms of life that we simply don't find. You should be able to find an animal, for instance, between the clams, the plesiopods, and the snails, the gastropods. You should be able to find an animal between the gastropods and the cephalopods. These are all members of the mollusk group. So there should be some relationships that are found there, and they are very difficult to establish. You should be able to find connections between reptiles and mammals. I had the privilege of visiting as a teacher the Smithsonian years ago. Dr. Houghton was so kind and gave me some of his time, and he showed me some of the specimens that they have in the Smithsonian, which are among the best in the world. And one of the specimens that he showed me, which I thought was particularly fascinating, was the mammal-like reptile. And what's interesting is that when you look at this particular specimen and you see the forms that it takes place, it's a mammal-like reptile, but why is it called a mammal-like reptile? Well, they're attempting to fill in a link between the mammals and the reptiles, and this animal has one bone in the lower jaw and one bone in the inner ear, which would fit that model. If a layman looks at it, he would say, well, there's an alligator, because there isn't much else that would suggest the kind of link that we're talking about. So it's kind of important to realize that it is difficult to find an animal between these two forms. And science, one of the beauties of science is that when science has a mistake or a problem, it eventually corrects itself as new finds are discovered. That isn't always true of religion, but it is true of science. And what has happened is that in recent years, there have been many questions raised about the validity of the single tree of evolution. Dr. John Bonner at Yale University and Dr. George Kirkut at the University of West Berlin back in the 20th century proposed what they called a forest of evolution. Their proposal was that some of these cases, and I just made reference to two rather simple ones, some of these cases could be explained much better if instead of assuming a single tree to all of life and a single ancestor to all of life, if the view wouldn't be better expressed by suggesting that life started in many different places, and that the changes that have occurred in many different trees of the forest of evolution. What that would suggest then is that there are groupings. The fish tree, for example, would be a form, and I'm using the simplest terms here rather than use Pisces or Herpes or one of the more complicated terms, but would suggest that all animals that are of that particular description would be in the same tree, and that would include fish and amphibians, and that the evolutionary changes that have taken place within that tree. Now, in some cases, that works very well. We do have an animal called Samoria, which is between the amphibians and the reptiles, and there's considerable debate as to whether it should be classified as an amphibian or to a reptile. So it fits the idea of evolutionary change that we've described. The bird grouping would be another grouping that is used. And the suggestion is that many changes have occurred within the bird grouping. And how big might that grouping be? Well, one suggestion that has happened in recent years is that perhaps the dinosaurs were in that group. Perhaps at least some of the dinosaurs were warm-blooded. And we are finding feathers on dinosaurs, which would strongly support that viewpoint. Feathers are not always used the same way. Feathers are not just for flight. Feathers are also used, for instance, in the case of the penguin, as a way of streamlining the bird's effects through water. The air bubble understandings of how feathers work in the water with the penguin is amazing. It's phenomenal. It's a beautiful design feature. An ostrich has a different use for feathers. So that grouping may be quite large. The mammals, including wide ranges of mammals, may in fact be related. We talked about the cross between the goat and the sheep called a jeep. And I don't know whether you're able to follow me here or not, but if you're tracking, this may sound vaguely familiar to you. Because way back in the earlier part of the last presentation, we talked about the meaning of the word kind. And I'd like to refresh your memory of 1 Corinthians 15:39. All flesh is not the same flesh. But there is one kind of flesh of men, and listen to this, another flesh of beasts, another of fishes, and another of birds. Now, he didn't say the flesh of robin, the flesh of blue jay, the flesh of Canadian jay, the flesh of stellar jay, the flesh of blackbird, the flesh of crow. He said the flesh of birds. He didn't say the flesh of salmon, the flesh of trout, the flesh of bullhead, the flesh of black bass. He said the flesh of fish. The taxonomic classifications of the forest of evolution and what the Bible actually describes as the different kinds are incredibly close. And as more and more discoveries are being made, as more progress is being made in examining the fossil record, the better the evidence becomes that the biblical record is consistent and accurate with what the fossils show. It is also fascinating to realize that this classification system used in 1 Corinthians 15 is used throughout the whole Bible. Back in Genesis 1, the same grouping were used. Let the earth bring forth fish. Let the winged fowl from the heaven. Let the earth bring forth beasts. Let us create man in our image. That's the same four classifications. If you go to Genesis 6 and you look at the flood, you'll see the same thing. So what's interesting is that the classification system that man has developed agrees in terms of the history of the fossil record with what the biblical record says in terms of the kinds. And there's also, of course, the fact that the Bible talks about change. We have already discussed this a little bit. But do you remember, for example, what God said to the serpent back in Genesis 3 and verse 14? And even if you take it literally and don't get into whether it's poetic or whether it's symbolic or whether it's an allegory or whatever, it's very, very accurate in a literal sense. Genesis 3:14, upon thy belly thou shalt go, and dust shalt thou eat all the days of thy life. How did the snake get around before that? Well, if from now on, the rest of the days of your life, this is what you're going to do, then you must have been with legs before. I like to tell the story. I was doing a program in Lawton, Oklahoma many years ago, and it was an interview thing in a lunch show, and I was minding my own business and being a good boy, and we were talking about the change that the Bible talks about, what Jacob did with Laban's flocks, and the origin of the races of man, and so forth, and I mentioned this passage, and at that point, a guy walks in the studio carrying this huge, huge snake. To me, it looked huge anyway. It was the biggest snake I'd ever seen. It was a boa constrictor. And it was turns out he was from the local zoo, and the people who ran the program and invited him to come in after me. And he had overheard what I was saying, and he said, well, let me show that to you. And so he brought this huge snake out and turned him over. And actually, that turned out to be an experience, because you get a big snake under hot lights in a studio. The snake was not a happy camper. It took three or four of us to hold him down. But you can see the vestigial legs, the spurs that the snake has. So in a very literal sense, that statement is accurate. Another interesting perspective on this is that in a high school teaching experience, it's been interesting to notice how long it takes for new discoveries in science to get in the textbooks. But one thing that is interesting is that the textbooks and the charts that are sent to us in the public schools to use with the textbooks are just beginning to get this concept across. And this whole cladistic idea is being promoted. I have a chart that I just got that shows the fish tree. And what's interesting is that on the fish tree, they have the jawless fish and they have all the modern fish. But down at the very bottom of it, they also have some of the dinosaurs. So that viewpoint is beginning to gain some footing. And it is interesting to realize that that whole idea is being promoted in an increasing degree. I mentioned this earlier, but this is a very personal thing with me. When I was an atheist, I was, among other things, going to write a book. I was going to write an atheist book that would destroy those who believed in God once and for all. And that was a very arrogant and rather stupid view. But nonetheless, I was young and trying to learn. And so I decided to write this book by teaching myself Hebrew and go back to the original language and prove it wrong. So I taught myself a little bit of Hebrew and studied with some rabbis and people who knew Hebrew. And then I went back and started through the Genesis account to prove it wrong. And what I ran into was some of the things I've just shared with you. The meaning of the word kind, the difference between creating and making. And that was before quantum mechanics and string theory and this sort of thing was in vogue. But even at that time, it was recognized that the source of the Big Bang was something that was a singularity that did not conform to the normal laws of simple classical physics. And I found myself increasingly confused as to how I could possibly maintain that the Bible was myth and there was no God, when I saw this incredible accuracy in the Genesis account, even in this area where there had been so much controversy and so many people that thought there was such a great conflict. It was 7 years before I finally realized not only did the integrity of the scripture stand up, but the evidence that there was design and purpose and intelligence and reason and all the things that I had learned in my studies in science And all that together compelled me to say, okay, there is a God, and it is the God of the Bible. It was still a long time before I came to believe that, quote, in him we live and move and have our being, and that Jesus is, in fact, the truth, the way, and the life, and no one comes to the Father but by him. But a beginning was to realize the integrity of the Bible. Science forced me to understand there was something out there. And the Genesis account and the things we have talked about here led me to believe that something was, in fact, the God of the Bible. What's interesting about this is that the Bible challenges us to do this. And we can go all the way back and see that there is a very important concept about how we understand God and the way God works in the creation. And in our next presentation, we want to look at that. Is God a magician or is God an engineer? And we'll talk about that in the next program.